Yo, welcome to another episode of Simply Bitcoin IRL. Today we have two very special guests. We have Preston Pish and American HODL. But before we start the show, I want to give a very special shout out to the Bitcoin companies that make this show possible. SwanBitcoin.com, best place to build your Bitcoin stack. And I also want to tell you about their new offer. Bitcoin is generational wealth, and you can secure your bright orange future with the Swan IRA. Real Bitcoin, no taxes. Swan offers both traditional and Roth options to best fit your needs. Create your IRA and start adding Bitcoin in less than 1 minute. Transfers and rollovers are available. Swan's Bitcoin experts will get you set up with no transfer fees, no minimum balance requirements. This is a real thing, not ETF or other derivative. Get the real thing. Get it at Swan. Go to swan.com/IRA for more details. And of course, the biggest Bitcoin conference on the face of the earth, Bitcoin 2023. It's going to be hosted in sunny Miami Beach, May 18th through the 20th, 2023. And you can use the promo code SIMPLY. All right, everybody, let's start the show. What's up, dude?
What's up, buddy?
How's life?
Chilling, man. Just trying to survive this bear market, you know?
Is it survival? Is that what it is?
You know what's funny, man? When we hit 20, like 6K the first time, like in, I don't know when that was, like before June, so like May of 22, I was like, okay, this is like, it's a reasonable bottom for the bear. You know, I can see it. 26 makes sense. And then we fell to 50. And I was like, this sucks. I'm gonna fucking kill myself. No. And then now that we're back around like 28, I'm like, this is reasonable. This is a reasonable place to be, you know.
But dude, I mean, like, we've been here a minute, right? So this is my this is my seventh year. I know you've been here a couple more years than me.
One more year. I got like a year and a half on you.
Why is it still so painful?
Yeah, I think just human psychology is that it's always painful, right? It's like, you know, I said this on Noster the other day, that the most underappreciated meme for the psychology of hodling Bitcoin is the meme where the guy has the shotgun in his mouth, and it's like later Bitcoin goes to 100K and he's got the shotgun in his mouth. That's what it is. It's like Bitcoin went to $1,000 and you were happy. It went to $10,000 and you're like, oh, I'm scared. It went to $100,000 and you're like, I'm ready to fucking kill myself. Like that's... That's investor psychology. And, you know, there were a lot of people, I'm not going to name names, but there were a lot of people I knew who freaked out and bailed this time around, because like Bitcoin did some shit that they didn't expect it to do. And it's like, okay, well, Bitcoin is never going to do what you think it's going to do. Bitcoin just does whatever it does, and you're along for the ride. And I guess somewhere you forgot that, or maybe you weren't ready to hodl the amount that you had, or maybe, you know, you weren't really that invested, or maybe you were kind of LARPing about some of the shit you were saying, whatever it was, like, I don't know. But a lot of people got really emotionally disturbed this time around. And I know people selling at like 17K and shit like that. And it's like, I guess that's true every cycle. I just didn't know anybody who was such a pussy like that last time around. And now I did, you know, so I got to see it up close. And I sympathize, because the feelings are the same, the coward and the hero. They feel the same way, right? But it's what you do with the feeling that matters. Like, you feel the same fear. Everybody, when Bitcoin plummets, you can go on Twitter and be as stoic as you want and be like, oh, I didn't even care. I'm better than you because I'm stoic, you know, whatever. And it's like, no, you're not. You freaked out. You had a little moment to yourself where you're like, what if I lose all my money? And that was in the back of your head, right? Everybody has this. It's okay to like talk about it. But it's what you do with it. And then, so what I do with it is I go, yeah, I'm not going down like this. I'm not going down like this. Okay? I'm going to fucking hodl until I told myself zero or fucking millions and millions. I'm not going to just sit here and just accept 17. No.
I mean, they don't call you American HODL for no reason, brother. But let me ask you something. I personally bought into the whole we're going 100K.
Yeah.
Like, were you like, what happened there? And then there's like this theory on Bitcoin Twitter that, I'm not gonna lie, kind of depresses me a little bit, where it's like the diminishing returns of Bitcoin, which, by the way, makes sense, right? It's a lot harder to go from 100,000 to 200,000 than it was from $1 to $2, right? Yep. But I still don't think we're quite there. I still think we're like, we're a couple cycles away from that. So, like, why the fuck didn't we hit 100K? What happened there?
So I think here's my theory. There's a I've heard some different shit for why people think this might be the case, but here's my theory. I think we let Wall Street know our target. And I think Wall Street was in this time. They weren't in 2017. And since Wall Street knew the target, they knew the target was 100K. They were like, oh, we'll start shorting it at 70, right? Because that's what Wall Street does. They're like, oh, okay, all the retail idiots think it's going to 100. So they're going to hold out. We're going to make our fucking bread and then we're going to rebuy at the bottom. Yeah. And we didn't realize that basically we had gone from the tide pool to the ocean and there'd be sharks in the ocean and the sharks want to fucking eat you. And we were all like just swimming around like we're the biggest thing in the tide pool. No, like you live in the ocean now, bitch. The sharks are going to eat your ass. And that's what happened to basically everybody. And also it's like, listen, man, when we were at the top, like when we, it was November of 21, I made a very conscious decision to myself. I was like, okay, you could sell now and have like, you know, a lot of money and then you could attempt to rebuy or whatever. But what you really got to do is just make the decision to hodl and just gut it out for a few years. And I'm happy with that decision. You know, it's a tough decision to make though. Most people will bail. Most people can't do it.
I completely agree. I mean, I made a meme of this on Bitcoin Twitter. It's like Bitcoin or slavery. Anyways, before we keep going, Preston, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing good. I'm so sorry. Cause in my mind, this was happening in like 45 minutes from now. And I was sending you charts. I was literally sending you a chart on Twitter. And I saw your note like, hey, I'll see you real soon. And it was like a couple minutes before the top of the hour. I was like, hold on a second. Do I have my times mixed up? And I did. So I apologize. I'm a mess.
No, all good, man. Happy to have you. By the way, I think you're using your computer microphone, not your very nice.
No, I probably am. I'm a disaster right now. So yeah, I'm gonna see if I can get that.
All good. You still sound great though. Well, we're happy to have you, Preston. Thanks for joining us.
Ooh, look at Preston with the multiple angles.
I know, dude. Sophistication.
Like multiple screens here. Let's try another one.
Beautiful.
Is it the right mic?
Yeah,
that sounds like better audio.
You're coming in great.
I'm a total disaster right now.
You're beautiful. Coming in great. Okay, so what I was asking HODL, Preston, is I think a lot of people were disappointed that we didn't hit 100K Bitcoin. I think a lot of people were expecting it. What's your take on it? Were you on the bullish side, on the bearish side? Personally, I was expecting 100K plus.
Yeah, I was too. Like no doubt about it. And you know what? When we had the first drop that was like a really significant drop that exceeded the vol that I think any of us were expecting, Caitlin Long came out and she said, hey, the derivatives market paper Bitcoin is, you know, providing this uncharacteristic input. And then when we basically had a double head, top, she was calling it the whole time saying that this was basically FTX and paper Bitcoin that basically cut the head off of the market, the way that we had characteristically seen previous cycles. So yeah, I think that's exactly what happened.
So I have a theory which isn't talked about a lot, right? Which was in the run up, the CCP banned Bitcoin mining, the hash rate dropped by like 60-70%. All those miners had to sell a ton of corn to relocate to different locations, the majority of which went to Texas. Mm-hmm. I believe that neutered the last bull market. Like that sell pressure from the miners, because it happened right in, like, you could, there's a, I don't know, Opti, if you could pull it up, but if you see the hash rate and the Bitcoin price, mm-hmm. it literally fell at the same exact time. So yeah.
I think that you had, multiple things that all contributed to basically not seeing the peak like we had in the previous cycles, and that could be definitely one of them. The amount of but that one only lasted for, I think that lasted for about a month, right, until the network reset itself. So you definitely had tons of difficulty that was in there that they were trying to offset, but yeah, it's kind of hard to go back and troubleshoot. Now, what I would focus on is like right now, I think that you have had way more consolidation of coins into really strong hands because you basically had a year and a half of sell pressure or compression of the market that you might not have had naturally. So I think that what that's doing is it's actually setting up this next bull run to be maybe stronger or more aggressive than what would have naturally happened because the way that it was manipulated or played with in the previous cycle. I'm curious if HODL would agree.
Yeah, no, Preston, I was going to say, I was talking to somebody, a mutual friend of ours, Joe Carlos, sorry about this. And, he was saying, if you get into a credit crunch, people are going to sell off their assets, right? They're going to sell off their risk assets and people will sell Bitcoin and Bitcoin will do, bad in that scenario. And I was saying to myself and to Joe, I was like, who's left? Who is left is going to sell their Bitcoin? Like if you went through Luna and FTX and, everybody on Twitter, I think the peak of fear was everybody saying that the GBTC Bitcoin was literally paper Bitcoin, that there was no Bitcoin in GBTC. That was like peak FUD in my opinion. If you went through all of that and you're still hodling your Bitcoin, you're going to sell it now to pay your bills.
There's no way.
Very unlikely. Right.
There's no way. I think that you have some of the strongest Bitcoin is in some of the strongest hands that it's ever been right now. And you have to match that with how much more knowledgeable hodlers are today versus 6 or 7 years ago as to what it is that they actually own. Like the people that I know that have significant amounts of Bitcoin, they would literally laugh you out of the room right now if you suggested that they need to sell some of that for whatever reason. Like their conviction is 10x what it was 5 years ago. And they're the ones squatting on a majority of the coins. So I think people in traditional markets don't understand how insanely powerful and important that particular point is with respect to the amount of supply that's left. And how it can't be debased. And then you combine that with the backdrop of what's happening in the macro world, or the fiat world, like it's a killer combo when you match those two things together. So,
Preston, where do you come down on cycle theory? There's been a lot of talk about cycle theory. Is cycle theory dead? Is the 4-year cycle still alive? Personally, I still think the 4-year cycle is real and is happening. And I think the reason why is because of reflexivity. Not only do minds move markets, but markets move minds. And I think because we believe this cycle to occur, some large number of market participants will act as if this cycle is real, thus making it real. That's what I mean? Do you agree with that? Or
I completely agree with you. I think the thing that makes it difficult is you're dealing with something that is when you look at the traditional legacy fiat fractional reserve disaster, like it's playing a role too. They feed off of each other, right? And it goes down to the mindset as well. So you have it's so complex, the two different systems, but as Bitcoin's market cap continues to grow, like its influence and its power is going to start to come to parity and match the legacy system. Now we're not like anywhere close to that right now. And that's why I think the past year and a half has been so brutal with respect to price action is because that legacy fiat system is still extremely powerful with the amount of buying power that's there and how much volatility you're seeing in the prices. But as we continue to move right on the timeline, I think that you might actually see the Bitcoin 4-year market cycle start to, I don't know that it would become more power. I think it's just going to continue to play this role like we've seen and what HODL's suggesting. I think that it's very real.
So Preston, you were sending me, you were talking, we're talking about the legacy system, right? And you were sending me some charts and Opti, if you could be so kind to pull them up. Why were these on your mind this morning? What is the significance of these?
Okay, so these are just bond yield curves. This is the US bond yield curve that you're looking at. Go ahead and so people can see as it's going up, it's selling off. Okay, and the reason there's so many lines is you're dealing with overnight money to 30-year debt and the whole host of durations in between is what that's showing. And the money that's the highest sell-off has been the short duration money, and the ones that are down at the bottom are your long duration money. What's ironic for people is like, so you're getting a lower rate to lend at 30-year versus like 3 month, which is what this is showing here. Now, why this is important is this is showing that central bankers have not got anything under control. Because when you look at these yields and you look at the numbers that are being produced here, you're still sub 4% across the whole yield curve. Yet inflation is still raging at, I'd have to look at the last print. HODL, you might know it off the top of your head, but like
I got to look it up
too. We're in excess. We're probably around like 6% or something like that. So all of this debt that you're seeing on this curve is still underperforming by 2% of just exceeding inflation prints. And so they don't have any of it under control. And you're seeing that the markets here in the US at least is starting to look like they're expecting a recession and for that inflation rate to drop. That's why you're seeing it flatline, and you've seen it flatline for what, like 6 months now here in the US. But what I want to show you is, so this is the US yield curve. Bring up the next chart, which is probably the UK. I think this is the UK. Okay, so this is their yield curve. You're not seeing the yield curve in the UK flatline yet. In fact, it's still aggressively selling off, chasing after their double-digit inflation prints. Okay. The next one, I think you just pulled that one up. This is the third one. This is the European bond yield curve. So that's the UK one. Go back to the tab on the far right. Yep, right there. This is the European yield curve. And so it's continuing to sell off like crazy because nothing is under control over there. These markets in the US and over in Europe are so interconnected. Is with the size of the banks and the bailouts and just like, it's basically one giant blob of disaster, whether you're here in the US, over in Europe or Japan, like it's a mess. And so the reason that I'm bringing this up and why I think this is so important and the chart that I sent you after this had already started, cause I had my times mixed up, was the oil chart. And why all of this is important. I know I'm talking about a whole different host of ideas here, but where I'm really going is none of this is under control. Hmm. And the reason none of it's under control is because now you have OPEC Plus coming out and saying, oh yeah, we're going to reduce the amount of supply that we're dropping into the market, right at a moment where people think that they're starting to get relief in the oil market. And what that's going to potentially do in the coming two quarters is you might have another run on oil where it's starting to take off again and it might go over $100 a barrel. And if that happens, the input for inflation, which is driving these charts to sell off, because all this debt is trying to perform and capture a yield that's better than inflation. That's why it's selling off. Because if you're getting 4% on your treasury and inflation 6%, you're guaranteed to lose 2% of your buying power by sitting in that treasury. But if oil starts taking off again, it's only doubling. Here's the oil chart. You can see it's had a lot of relief. Most of this was due to the Strategic Petroleum Reserve in the U.S. being providing a ton of supply into the market to offset the price as it was running away. But now you're at a point where OPEC is fighting back. And so you have this battle that's currently taking place between OPEC plus net producing countries versus net consuming countries that are trying to control things through treasury curves and printing a bunch of fiat money. And there's this battle taking place between net producers and net consumers that are basically making up this digital supply of units that they're just, you know, trying to control those and clawing them out of the market. And they're saying, you know what, we're gonna prevent the amount of oil that's going into the market too. And so that effect is insanely profound and insanely important for just the simple idea that none of this is under control. There is a battle taking place.
So Preston, correct me if I'm wrong here, but if we're sliding into recession, you would expect oil to go down, right?
Mm-hmm. Because there'd be less
people moving around in the economy, right? Less use, less demand for oil. So what would be the catalyst to cause oil to spike up, in your opinion?
Well, I think OPEC's play is, hey, if we can control the amount of supply, like we can make the price go up. Like if they just, if let's just take an extreme example. If they cut the amount they're supplying into the market by half, which they're clearly not doing that. But if they did, just to kind of understand the mechanics, like you're going to shoot the price to the moon on oil. And so I think their play is, oh, you think you're going to be able to create a recession and all this, this whole backstop facility that you just stood up is a play of, let me describe the mechanics of that real fast so people can understand. So, all the debt on every single bank's balance sheet was basically at a discount. We'll just say about 15%, which makes them insolvent. So they step in and they're like, well, you can just put those on deposit. And we'll basically bid that the whole treasury, all your treasuries by 10%. And then you're not insolvent anymore because, you know, it was a 5% interest that they would put it on deposit and then it gets bid to the premium. So basically they bid the price of every single debt instrument on their balance sheets by 10%, making them solvent. That's manipulating the market, right? So if I'm an OPEC plus, if I'm going to play devil's advocate and sit on the other side of the fence and say, all right, they're going to backstop this. They're going to put them on deposit. They're going to create a recession. Interest rates are going to come screaming back down. And then they're going to basically plop all those debt instruments back onto their balance sheet. And it's going to appear like they just diverted the crisis completely. That's the play. Okay. But what throws a wrinkle into that play is if you can actually create, if you can sustain the inflation and maybe even elevate the inflation further by controlling the number one supply input, which is energy, to all these supply chains, all of a sudden you are not the entity that you think you are as far as being able to drive recessions and control the global economy. There's another player that has a whole lot of power in this, which is the OPEC plus net producing countries that are saying, this is a bunch of BS. And we're going to go to battle on this and we're going to make you look like fools. So,
yeah, it's interesting too, because if you look at like, the Biden administration's lack of, you know, their unwillingness to produce oil, I wonder how fast we could turn on the spigots in America and Europe and get enough oil out if supply was to restrict. Probably not fast enough, right?
I heard that there hasn't been a lot of investment in the oil refinements. I heard the average age is like 20 years or something crazy like that. But what fascinates me is all the political motivations behind all of these decisions. And if you guys remember, right, what happened quickly after Russia invaded Ukraine, you know, Europe basically went into an energy crisis. Right. And we were being told the public was being sold for I don't know how long. Hey, you know, renewable energies, we could totally do this. There was this very famous video of Trump basically warning the Germans, saying, hey, you guys are beholden to Russia and whatnot. So I just, and then I'm going to tie this in with Bitcoin, of course. Under a Bitcoin standard, I don't think, you know, these types of decisions would be viable. And I think Saifedean touched upon this in the Bitcoin standard. I think like all of these decisions, all these politically motivated decisions or energy policies are just because governments have access to this money printer and it allows them to do all these crazy things.
Totally. Yeah. And this is how the other half of the world is fighting back, is they're saying, you think you're controlling this cycle, right? And they're looking at it and saying, well, how about this? And they're just basically taking a wrench and just throwing it into the gears by adjusting the supply of energy itself. And when they're doing that, if and this is a big if, because I don't know if they're actually going to be able to, maybe the recessionary inputs are way stronger than their suffocation of the supply of the oil market, like the speed of this. I don't know. But let's play devil's advocate and say that they're successful and the price of oil surges over 100 and maybe it goes up to like 140 or something crazy because maybe they're doing things behind the scenes to control that. Every person trading treasuries in the world, NATO, G7 treasuries, like, I'm sorry, you're getting your face ripped off twice, right? Like it is going to be devastating to that market if we continue to see energy prices run at a time where they desperately need these central bankers in the G7 countries desperately need a recession, desperately, to get any of this under control and to make the bank's balance sheet solvent again without these backstops and surgical tools that they're using.
You know, what's interesting too, is that the, you know, American investors are, you know, people who are in American equities, they don't want a recession either. And so, you know, I mean, the financial guys are balking at recession, and the market wants any sign of weakness coming out of the Fed. The market is like, let's just go immediately back up again. And we're closer to the all-time highs now than we are to the market bottom.
Yeah.
Right.
Which is crazy.
And this is after this aggressive cutting raising from the Fed, this aggressive raising from the Fed. And everybody was like, if the Fed hikes, I believed this 2 years ago, that if the Fed hikes, risk assets can't do well, big tech can't do well, Bitcoin can't do well. Turns out that's not true. Right. And so I think it's really complicated what's going on. It's hard to like get a handle on it.
It's counterintuitive because things that you would expect to be happening right now are not happening. In fact, they're doing the exact opposite. I'll give you an example. So like when I'm looking at unemployment numbers and I'm looking at this negative spread in credit that currently exists right now, you would expect equities to be getting ready for like a massive drop or to get just punished. And from momentum, if I'm just speaking strictly about momentum in equity right now is suggesting we're just getting ready to start a bull run.
Yeah.
Right? That doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And so the only way that I can wrap my head around that is the market is calling the BS of the central bankers and saying, no, I think you're going to have to debase the currency in such a drastic way. And in short order, like within the coming two quarters or three quarters, you're going to have to do that we are front running the move and we're bidding scarce, profitable equity. That's what I think is happening.
It's important to understand, like you were talking about, you know, the battle that was raging between, you know, OPEC and the powers that be over here. I mean, there's also a battle that's constantly always being waged between the Fed and the market. And what the Fed mainly does is psychologically manipulate the market, and the market attempts to, you know, tell whether the Fed is lying or not. Right. And I think more so than ever, the market has gotten wise to the fact that like, this is a game of chicken and none of us are swerving. If you look at the passive flows into ETFs, investors haven't blinked. I mean, the passive flows keep coming. They keep coming because where else are you going to go? There's no other game in town, right? And you're going to have to sit and take devaluation because of the inflation rate. And so even, you know, people in their 401ks haven't pulled. People who are, you know, just passively indexing haven't pulled. Like, so if it's a game of chicken, the market is not budging, right? And Powell is not budging also. So like something is going to have to give at some point.
Something's going to have to break, right? But right. Hold on. Because what fascinates me, and perhaps it's, you know, taking the orange pill and then kind of opens your eyes to a lot of things, is I don't think people would be necessarily okay with this system if they really knew what was going on. I think the vast majority of people are completely asleep to this. If you live in the United States, the bread and circuses are strong, so to speak. You have developed financial platforms. It's really in the global South that, you know, the guy in the suit on TV goes on, gives a speech on like why you have to use their money, and everyone doesn't really take them seriously. Yeah. That really hasn't happened in developed countries. You still take the guy on TV with the suit seriously, even though the things that he's saying, you know, like, I don't know if you guys have seen like the recent press conferences from Powell, like it, you know, to me, it doesn't even... Did you guys see that very famous video where he tried to explain why 2% inflation?
Right, yeah.
I hadn't, but I could imagine.
Like, it's so ridiculous, you know?
Nico, like, Powell has a dual mandate, right? And on the one hand, he's responsible for low unemployment. And on the other hand, he's responsible for price stability. And he's basically letting everybody know, I don't give a fuck about low unemployment. I'm trying to cause high unemployment, in fact. I only care about price stability. That's it. So, I mean, yeah, if you're one of the average Americans who, you know, you don't have many assets, you're working a job, you're living paycheck to paycheck, you don't have $400 in the event of an emergency, high unemployment is basically a death knell for you. And Powell and, you know, the powers that be are trying to cause that in order to save the sinking life raft. And they have to. There's no other move that they can really make. I mean, if we were sitting in the same chair, we would probably do the same thing that he's doing. In fact, I actually think Powell is a very good Fed chairman, right? It's just, he's been given an unwinnable task.
No doubt.
Yeah. I have the clip for you guys if you want to check it out. It's about 2 minutes. All right, let's do it.
For the general public, for those working families of people, why 2%? Why is getting it to 2% so important?
So that has become the globally agreed, essentially all major central banks target 2% inflation in one form or another.
How does that help my Nevada families? How does that help people in Nevada?
I'll tell you how it does. And it's not obvious how that is, but 2% inflation, to have people believe that inflation is going to go back to 2% really anchors inflation there, because, you know, the evidence is, and the modern belief is that people's expectations about inflation actually have an effect on inflation. If you expect inflation to go up 5%, then it will, you know, if everyone kind of expects that, because that's what businesses and households will be expecting, and it will kind of happen because they expect it. So having a 2% inflation goal, which we had for many years.
Okay. What did you just say?
No, I mentioned that. By the way, that's my senator, Cortez Masto. So I'm proud of her. She did a good job. Normally, I don't agree because she's a Democrat, but she did a good job.
I mean, I'm speechless.
Yeah, me too. I don't know what to say.
I don't even know what to say other than, like, what a clown show.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's explaining what a psychological manipulation game it is, though, because mm-hmm. he's saying if people believe it's going to be higher and we suck at our jobs, then it will be higher because we suck at our jobs, right? It's crazy.
Meanwhile, I mean, it's mathematical. It really is. You know, when you supply the amount of currency, I mean, I've used this example in some other interviews with, like, Monopoly. Like, if you flood the board with a bunch of monetary units, like, it's going to change the valuation of everything on the board. There's other ways to impact inflation beyond just the monetary, just the input of the units. I mean, you could go through a massive, like, if we're talking about a small jurisdiction, right, that has its own currency, if they go through, like, a situation where they're at war or they're dealing with this, they have to adjust the monetary supply. There could be damage to the infrastructure, which will drive prices. So, like, if I go in there and I destroy all the supply chains for oil, like, the price of oil is going to go up because it's harder to get it. So there's things that impact it, but at the core, on a long-term trend, like, if you're adjusting the number of units in the system, that's why it goes up. So the question is a very important one, and just watching them tap dance around is just, you know, hilarious, because there's no way you can answer that question.
It's so absurd. Like, why? And, you know, and this goes down to, like, the very important question that I believe that once people start asking this question, I don't think they'll have a response to it. And the reason I'm saying that is because if you look at all their proposals pushing their central bank, like the central bank digital currency, they always talk about making payments more efficient. For some reason, they avoid the inflation conversation altogether. And the reason I believe that is because it's indefensible. I don't think you can defend that position, especially if now we have an alternative that has proven that not only does it work, it actually gains in purchasing power over time. And I think the biggest tell is their reaction, or their hostility, better said, towards the industry. You know, Nick Carter wrote a great piece, right? Operation Choke Point 2.0. We all know how, you know, Caitlin Long's bank was treated, right? So it's just interesting how they're attempting, to use Christine Lagarde's own words, really close off that escape valve. They don't want people opting out in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Completely.
So where does this go from here, gentlemen? Things are obviously dire, as Preston was explaining earlier. You know, of course, we don't have a crystal ball, but, you know, what do you think happens in the next 6 months to a year? You know, I don't think we've seen a recession, Preston, or at least people don't realize that we're in a recession. So, you know, and the argument from the Fed is like, oh, you know, this is the soft landing that we were talking about. So do you still expect one in 2023 or 2024?
So I think people need to come to grips with what they're seeing in equity markets in particular, and Bitcoin might be drastically different than what the regular economy is doing. So you might have, like, ridiculous unemployment numbers, and you might have the stock market raging. And I think that that's something that none of us in our lifetimes have ever experienced or seen. And what you're getting, I did a different interview with somebody and I was talking about it from just like a mechanical engineering maybe standpoint, like resonant frequency. So resonant frequency is when you're supplying an input and the thing that's coming at you is basically 180 degrees out of phase of what you're trying to do. And so I think that you're starting to get to a point where central banking policy and inputs of more fiat is actually at resonant frequency with the rest of the economy. Right now is a perfect example where I was saying that the equity market on the NASDAQ and the S&P 500, HODL said it's closer to the high than it is the low. And you're at a point where the market would typically be getting ready to go through a big sell-off and then maybe central banking policy. But they're going to be supplying so much capital, so much, let me rephrase that, so much digital monetary fiat units into the system that I think it's going to blow people's mind because it's trying to offset just massive amounts of credit impairment that is occurring because you have this upside down yield curve against inflation. And so as they continue to supply this, they're supplying more of the same policies that got us here, that broke supply chains, that is causing prices to rip. And so it goes to this, like, where are you going to put your money to preserve it? You have to own something that's scarce and you have to own something that generates free cash flows that's not going to debase the number of shares that represent that equity. Those are the only two places you can go to preserve your buying power. One, especially when you're talking about Bitcoin that has a really small market cap that has the potential to mature into this really substantial market cap, is where you're going to see the biggest bang for your buck versus, you know, like Apple stock or something that's going to probably remain profitable, that's not going to debase the number of scarce shares that exist, that's going to do really well in the face of fiat that most people are used to measuring it against. So, I know I was a little bit all over the place with the response, but you got to expect market conditions that are very different than what you've seen in the last 40 years. They're going to be out of sync with each other. You're getting this resonant frequency that's just causing disruption in supply chains that are barely profitable, which only continues the unwind in the difficult situation with respect to inflation.
You know, there's this scene in the Simpsons movie when they put a giant dome over the town and he goes, "Are you telling us we're trapped like rats?" And he goes, "No, rats can't be trapped this easily. You're trapped like carrots." You know, that's what they've done to the market. There is nowhere to escape to. And you know what I mean? For those of us who are in Bitcoin, like, we already have our plan is in place. We're already good. We're in cold storage. Like, everything's fine. But like, imagine if you had to get out immediately into Bitcoin in size and all of the on-ramps and off-ramps were all wonky and cut off. How are you going to do it? You really can't, right?
Yeah.
And so I think another thing too is, like, we always talk about Bitcoin being so volatile, right? And that, you know, there was this Michael Saylor idea he was promoting like 2 years ago that the volatility would go down over time and we would collar this asset as the big money came in. That turned out not to be the case. I think the reason it wasn't the case is because the traditional system is growing more volatile by the day, like Preston was talking about. All of these inputs and outputs are all over the map. And, you know, moment to moment in the market, the emotions are so strong that it either feels like we're going into the Great Depression and we're all going to be fucked and we're going to lose all our money, or, oh my God, we're all so rich. This is like .com 2.0. This is amazing, right? And the market has become extremely bipolar and it oscillates wildly between these two phenomena, right? And so I think what's going to happen ultimately is what Preston said, which is that the vast majority of Americans, people without assets, people who, you know, work a 9-to-5, live paycheck to paycheck, don't have a lot of savings, they're going to be really hurt by the policies that come later, because in order to prop the whole system afloat, you're going to have to flood the zone with cash, right? It's like that Steve Bannon saying, flood the zone with shit. You're going to have to flood the zone with cash. Like, you just have to. And you have to keep flooding it and flooding it and flooding it. And basically, like, every time you print, you're going to have to print twice as much as the time before. And it's going to be half as much time between printing cycles. So you're going to print twice as much, half the time. And that's an exponential. That's what Jeff Booth talks about. Like, and we're just going to a place where, here's another thing. Like, Balaji has this bet about hyperinflation coming to America in 90 days, right? People have been talking about hyperinflation. I was in a room of some of the dumbest people on Clubhouse the other day, and they were talking about hyperinflation and the dollar's collapse against the BRICS nations, et cetera. Now, I'm not saying that that is happening right now, okay? But I am saying that at some point, this system unwinds, and hyperinflation is always demarcated by a loss of confidence in the underlying currency. So when you see people begin to lose confidence in the underlying currency and they talk about it in mainstream media, it's a canary in the coal mine. It's a tell that something is going on, right?
And back to the point that I was making earlier, Hoddle, with the showing like the UK's bond yield curve and the European bond yield curve, like we're so interconnected here in the US, our yield curve doesn't look all that bad relative to theirs. They're double digit inflation. They're dealing with a situation from an energy standpoint that they have no control over. And if you don't think that a market of that size can have a spillover effect here to the US and the rest of the planet, you just don't understand how interconnected things are.
I think something people don't know about is the euro dollar system, right? And just how many dollars are created in Europe. I think it's actually more than are created in America. Mm-hmm. So yeah, not only are we interconnected, but it's basically the same system across the board, right?
Yes.
So we should pull up the Opti. It seems like you have them, so we could visualize for anyone who's looking at it what Preston was referring to.
So this is the U.S.'s yield curve, and I think you get a lot of U.S. pundits that look at this and say, "Oh, it's, you know, the credit market is basically saying that the recession is coming and that the Fed has finally got what they wanted, right? With all their tightening, based on looking at this curve." That's what I think most U.S. pundits would say. But where I would push back, and I'm not saying I'm right, I'm just saying where I would push back is I would pull up the next two curves, which is the UK here, right? None of that is under control at all. And then the European bond yield curve, which is here, that's not under control. That is a credit market that is aggressively selling off with tons of volatility that seems to be normally, like if you were going to do an average true range of the volatility there, it's completely in keeping with the trend of volatility. And they don't have any of this double-digit inflation under control in Europe. And at a time where OPEC is saying that they're going to, try to... I mean, they didn't say they're going to do this, but their actions are saying that they're trying to keep prices elevated for energy. So, like, whatever it is you think you know based off of the past 40 years in what brings stability to markets, I think you can just, you know, light it on fire and throw it in the trash can, because that's where we're at right now.
There's a lot of boomer investors who are extremely confident, I would say overconfident, about the fact that we're going to run the 70s back. I don't think that's happening
at
personally.
All.
Now, maybe I'm a young idiot who doesn't know what he's talking about, but it just doesn't seem like the same history to me.
Because
here's what's different. So the actions of manipulating the cost of capital for 40 years, and I think it's important that in that first 40 years, it wasn't anything like it's been in the last 10 years. Okay, I will emphasize that. But in the last 10 years, the manipulation of the cost of capital itself, which is manipulating the price of everything, has been so grossly overused, especially with QE. And now basically this backstop is basically yield curve control is what it is. It's yield curve control, whether people want to believe it or not. You are so grossly manipulating the cost of capital that the real impact is that you are destroying supply chains. You are consolidating enterprise. Instead of there being 10 businesses that can provide widget X, there's 5 or there's 3. And then when one of those 3 go bankrupt because their energy inputs are too expensive, now there's 2. What does that do to the price of things? If you can only choose from 2 vendors, it makes the prices go up. It's that simple. And so what they're systemically doing is they're poisoning a naturally free and open economy and all the supply chains that supply the pieces and parts that would make prices most optimal. We saw that peak and now it's undoing itself. And it's like a water wheel. Once it starts spinning the other way, it will keep spinning that way because that's, you know, the momentum that it has. And so they've conducted these policies. It's actually brought a lot of stability in the form of like prices for everyday consumers. But what they're not seeing is the prices of scarce things like healthcare, like energy costs, like meat, and like these things that that people take for granted are now starting to unravel themselves, and they think they can just step in and do some keystrokes by adjusting the amount of units that are in the system because it's worked in the past to bring stability. But now they've actually got a systemic, fundamental, physical issue with supply chains, and they've got OPEC plus net producers that are pretty pissed off about how mm-hmm. things have gone over the last, particularly the last 10 years. And they're saying, they're fighting back and they're saying, no, we're not going to participate in this scam anymore. Is really what their response is by what they're doing with oil prices.
Also, you don't have the same ability to do financial repression that you did 50 years ago, right? Because what we're seeing is we're seeing an analog traditional system come up against a new digital system. And every time we've seen that, the analog system has been completely dematerialized by the digital system. So if you want to say, hey, we're going to cut the ACH on-ramps and off-ramps, well, I can guarantee you that the digital system is going to find a quicker, more efficient way around that almost immediately, right? You want to cut SWIFT, you want to cut FedNow, the digital system is going to find a way around that. And it's going to be able to dematerialize you. So you can't fight too hard against the exits, because if you do, there's a Streisand effect to it too, where you know, suddenly you say, the Fed says ban Bitcoin, or, you know, the US government says ban Bitcoin, and suddenly people go, wait, why do they want to ban Bitcoin? Right? It's like yelling fire in a crowded theater. It'd be the worst thing they could possibly ever do.
Not to mention, like, the US, they don't benefit from having that geographic. With, you know, Bitcoin lives in cyberspace. You can't really, you know, and you could see this with their attempts to regulate the shitcoin casinos, mm-hmm. right? You know, they just move overseas, right? You know, they're doing their business over the internet. It's a lot harder for them to, you know, use the tools that they're accustomed to using for a very long time. And now I think they know that. And the reason I'm saying that is the recent, you know, so-called TikTok ban, which I think that's the excuse, that's the justification that they needed. But if you read the wording in that bill, you know, it's just giving so much more power to the, you know, the bureaucracy, really. And just look, whatever we say, you know, is a danger to national security, you know, will be banned. And in my opinion, as a first generation American, I'm seeing this and I'm like, this wasn't the country that I was, you know, sold as. Like, what is going on here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Restrict Act, I think, is deeply un-American. I think everybody who's against it should rally to make sure that it doesn't pass. But it won't be the last time they try something of that sort, like a Patriot Act 2.0 for the internet. Again, there's a bunch of people, these boomers, you know, these elder boomers are sitting on the top of the power structure. And, you know, they don't know what to do about this new world, right? And frankly, they're a little long in the tooth. They've been sitting on these, you know, high perches for too long. They should have moved on 10 or 15 years ago and let younger people, Gen X, take their place. But they haven't. They're scared of the internet and they want to regulate it away, create a driver's license for the internet, this kind of stupid shit. And all of that is deeply un-American. You can't beat China by becoming China. We are a free and open society, and we always should be if we're going to remain on top. If we're not, then, you know, what we've seen over time when reserve currencies switch is that the more fair, the more rules-based, the more capitalist system, it tends to win out, right? And so there's all this talk of the dollar versus the yuan, or, you know, the G7 versus the BRICS nations. None of those are as fair, as capitalist, or as rules-based as Bitcoin is, right? And none of the frontiers are as open or as wide or as decentralized as the internet. The internet is full of possibility, and Bitcoin is the coin of the realm. So if you're asking me what becomes the next reserve currency, I think it's obvious what I think.
Yeah. And I think El Salvador, like, you're seeing what is happening in El Salvador. And then I think the tell is how much the corporate media machine is attacking, to the point that, you know, there was you heard the saying, right? Nayib Bukele is a danger to democracy, even though he has 90% approval rating, even though he's lowered crime rates to historic low, and he's had record GDP growth ever since they started tracking that sort of thing. That guy's a danger to democracy. But what we're doing, no, don't worry about that, right? So I just find that interesting. Do you guys believe that it is Bitcoin, that El Salvador adopting a Bitcoin standard has played a role in the success of El Salvador. And the reason I'm saying this, right, is Preston, you know what I'm talking about. American HODL, you know what I'm talking about. Once you take the orange pill, it kind of changes your operating system and the view, the way that you view the world. All of a sudden, you become filled with hope. You see opportunity in the future when the money in your savings are increasing in purchasing power over time. Most people, the vast majority of the world, are still in that inflationary mindset. Now, what happens when you adopt that deflationary mindset, but you apply it to a whole country? And I think that played a role. Maybe I'm seeing something that's not there. I don't know. Preston, what's your take on that?
I definitely think it's played a role. And I think, this is an interesting stat that I heard somebody say. If you started dollar cost averaging Bitcoin at the peak of the last cycle at like 69 or 70K or whatever it was, and you dollar cost averaged every day, right now you're up.
Mm-hmm.
Which is insane to think about how profound that is, that you would actually be up in your position if you dollar cost average every single day since the top, because we're nowhere near the top right now. So there's just this really interesting thing about Bitcoin, even though it's got so much volatility. If you're dollar cost averaging into it consistently, like you can see the impact of the fiat lie so clearly, but so few people do. It's so simple, but so few people do it. So when I look at Bukele, I think he's kind of taken on this approach of like, hey, we're going to start looking at how we operate as a country with Bitcoin as our unit of account. And it's a difficult transition, especially for a country like El Salvador or any other one of these countries that have the IMF putting them into slavehood with the actions that they make by just continuing to roll their debt and roll it into larger and larger numbers. And the way they were really able to control that was by just reducing the yield on the debt, but the debt was just getting larger and larger. You can do that with the duration but you can only do it as long as inflation's not going up, right? And so now you're at this crossroads where Bukele could see the farce for what it was, made the transition, appears to be doing some type of strategy where his country is trying to stack Bitcoin. I think it's hard for them because I don't necessarily know that they're a net producer, which makes it very difficult. Bitcoin is for net producers, period. Like it's nearly impossible to stack it unless you're a net producer of some sort. You're going to have to sell it because you just have to if you're a net consumer. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's the challenge for those types of countries is if they're not net producers, it's going to be really hard for them to take on a Bitcoin strategy and to actually retain their treasury in Bitcoin. But for countries that are net producers, it's going to be a lot easier. And I think Bukele is where I really like Bukele. He has demonstrated to the world what it looks like. He's basically like a MicroStrategy Michael Saylor, but for like a nation state level. He's demonstrating to the world what it looks like. As long as he can stay on that standard and continue to do it, and hopefully we can get a bull run to really kind of demonstrate to the world what it does for a country like that, I think it's going to be insanely profound what happens in El Salvador moving forward. I think it's brought in a lot of just outside tourism and attention. And I think his policy with respect to trying to attract Bitcoin country or Bitcoin companies into his country is massive. And I think that you're going to see some of the fruition of like what that means in the coming 3 years.
100%. So Nayib Bukele, the nation state model will be vindicated and mm-hmm. the public company model will be vindicated as well. Yeah. And that all happens the next cycle. So holy cow. HODL, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think one of my big takeaways from El Salvador is that nation states that flourish over the next 100 years are going to have to respect the sovereign individual. And what does this mean? It means you're going to have to respect encryption-powered individuals. So these are individuals who have asymmetry against you, right? So if you want to fuck with them, they have a means to defend themselves, which is asymmetric. And I think this is something that you're going to have to put at core. The smallest minority in the world is that of the individual. America used to be a place that prize the individual. And if we're going to flourish over the next 100 years, we need to find that ability to put the individual front and foremost. And if we don't, then we're going to lose out to nations that do.
100%. 100%. And you see that. It was interesting. You had an article in Bloomberg, Hong Kong, with the approval of the CCP, is saying, hey, we actually want to be, you know, a friendly, quote unquote, their words, not mine, crypto city. Right. So I think America, specifically, you know, the bureaucratic elite need to wake up to this reality. If, you know, you can't Bitcoin, you can't, Opti says this all the time, you can't ban Bitcoin, you can only ban yourself from Bitcoin. Anyways, right. Gentlemen, we're at the top of the hour. I don't want to take more of your guys' time. Preston, thank you so much for joining us today. American HODL, you as well. Preston, why don't you tell everybody what you're working on these days? Anything top of mind?
Thanks for having me, first of all. I deeply apologize for messing up my schedule and being late. I was looking forward to this conversation all week with both of you guys. You can find me. I'm on a podcast. We Study Billionaires. My Bitcoin specific show comes out every Wednesday. Active on Twitter, Noster. But thank you so much for having me. This was a pleasure. I wish we had more time to chat.
Thanks, Preston. I really appreciate it. No worries at all. That's happened to me a couple times, so I completely understand.
I'm so embarrassed.
All good, brother. American HODL, what's up, dude? What do you work? Where are you these days, man? You're talking to
I'm
me.
I'm in cyberspace, bro. I'm in your computer, man. No.
American HODL's AI, by the way. He's not real.
I'm just spending time with family, talking to people about Bitcoin all day long, basically just working for free, unpaid, being a net consumer, unfortunately. So you know, maybe I have to get some money coming in at some point. I think the thought I would like to leave people with is that, you know, I think we've never seen a technology like Bitcoin that enables the type of change that can be brought about by individuals since, you know, maybe like the printing press. I mean, and Bitcoin, if you can think of Bitcoin as the anti-printing press. And so Bitcoin is a technology that enables you to change things through sheer force of will, right? Determination and discipline. And like, to me, that's what HODLing is all about. And I think of, you know, the Citadel as being a sphere of influence that grows outwardly from you and that teaches other people about individual rights and, you know, the will of individuals to change society. And so, you know, this thing goes as far as you want it to go. If you want Bitcoin to put all of your descendants on their own Dune style planet where you guys fucking mine for spice that's created by space worms and shit, like, you can do that. Or if you just want to buy the house with the white picket fence and the Toyota Camry in the front, you can do that too, right? Like, it's, you can choose your own moon adventure. And, you know, my moon adventure is having a seat at the table of power so that we can change everything so the world is not such a cruel, corrupt slave system. You know what
Amen.
I mean? That's
Amen.
Just me. That's just me.
Amen. I love that. I love that. All right, gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. Guys, thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of SBL IRL. We'll be back tomorrow with the live show, 12:15 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Love you all. Catch you guys later.